My Unconventional Life, Stranger in a Southern Land, Inconclusive Breakdown, Turnbuckle Throwbacks, Neckbreaker, and The Shining Wizards. These are the shows of the Shining Wizards Network. Available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Audio Boom, and at ShiningWizardsNetwork.com. Entertainment here.
The one place where news, opinions, and entertainment are the way you like it. This is Rant EM Radio.
The recognized symbol of excellence in sports entertainment.
Get ready for another action-packed Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast with your hosts, the Impact player Phil Rea.
What's up, everybody? Big Phil here from Turnbuckle Throwbacks checking in. I'm actually at the workplace as people walk by, and I'm not going to be able to be home and record something for to preview this next throwback from the way back, so I figured I'd do it from the workplace. Nice, miserable fall day here in New York City, and doing some overtime tomorrow, today, working like an animal so I could pay some bills and bring you guys some good, good quality fucking, programming. So anyway, this next installment of Throwbacks from the Way Back is episode 2 of my first, 2 of 5, I should say. And this one is episode, I believe, 27, Enter the Mega Powers. This was Dave's first appearance on Turnbuckle Throwbacks. He wasn't an official member yet. I had just met Dave WrestleMania weekend a couple of months prior. He was doing some stuff in film, and I plugged him on another show I was doing. He came on, and I realized that he was a good talent, and I figured, hey, man, come on out and enjoy yourself. And that's pretty much what he did. So he came on the show, and we did SummerSlam 91, and it was a pretty fantastic fucking show. And then that started the kinship between myself and the Mega Powers, who to this day is an asset, an ally, one of my dearest friends. And he still pops on now from time to time and helps out with the show as an admin on the page. And, it always gives me some kind words, and he'll probably be checking in a couple of weeks on some live stuff. So speaking of live stuff, we have a fantastic live show November 4th. I will have a very special guest in studio. We're doing hard. What is it? What was he doing? Let me check my notes here. Hold on. Ah, yes. We're doing November to Remember, 1996. So it's going to be a fantastic card. And we'll have some fun. We're going to open the phone lines probably, do a kick-ass throwback for you, and then hopefully everybody will be all right. And we'll move on and finish this year strong. It's been a terrible year for me anyway, so I'm trying to finish out strong, trying to give you guys some good content. And, of course, don't forget to support all the shows on RantEMRadio.com, ShiningWizardsNetwork.com. Go to TurnbuckleThrowbacks.com and click on all the links to all our friends' shows as well. And I just hope you guys enjoy this one. This one's a kick-ass, nice throwback from May of 2013. It's Enter the Mega Powers. It's Philly Rea. It's Turnbuckle Throwbacks. You guys take care of yourselves. Have a great Halloween. And I will see you guys next week, live and direct, once again. Peace. Player Mr. Philly Rea, and I have a special guest. Special guest, who are you tonight?
Well, when there's smoke, there's fire. And when there's fire, there's the Mega Powers.
That's right, Dave. Mega Powers of the Shining Wizards camp. How are you, sir?
Oh, I'm doing awesome, man. How are you?
I'm fantastic. Let me just give everybody a brief background. I met Dave a while ago on the phone, actually, when the Wizards were doing their stuff, calling in and stuff. I didn't get to meet Dave personally until WrestleMania weekend. We connected on another project Dave was doing, and when Dave got a wind of me doing this, he shot me the idea of coming on, and I picked an opportunity, and now here we are on a very rare Tuesday night, actually. I don't do, like, a weekday thing with this, because...
And we're not in Texas.
And we're definitely not. It's definitely not a Tuesday in Texas.
No.
And well, yeah, that was a good card. That's gonna be another podcast. Tonight is a very special podcast. Now, when Dave reached out to me for the idea of this, I was happy because I got to be honest with you. I actually missed going to this card by a couple of hours. Someone had offered me a ticket. And I remember it well because my parents had let me get it on pay-per-view. I bought the pay-per-view, like, way in advance. So I already had it. And I was out running errands, and someone was going to give me a ticket to go, because it was actually at the Garden, and we'll get into that in a couple of seconds. But I remember I was about 17 at the time. And to be honest with you, I was so stoked that it was come back, because I was at the first SummerSlam, which was in 88. That was the Mega Powers versus the Mega Bucks.
Yes.
I sat nine rows behind what's his nuts? Isaiah Thomas. Was it Isaiah Thomas? Yeah, it was Isaiah Thomas.
The events.
Yeah. And it was like floor seats almost. If you're a basketball fan, then you know like the floor seats at the Knicks on the hardwood. I was like 9 or 10 rows behind that. So okay. it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool. All right. So SummerSlam 1991, that's where we are. Dave, tell me why this is so significant to you.
Well, for me, this was probably, well, when I was a kid, how old was I? I was under 10, that's for sure. And I didn't have cable, so anytime that there was, a WWF pay-per-view, I was absolutely, going batshit crazy because I wanted to watch it and I couldn't. And, for me, at this point in time, this was, like, probably besides WrestleMania 6, like, one of those pay-per-views that, it just killed me inside that I could not watch it live. And just with this card alone, like, it was stacked. And, as we were kind of talking about before we got on the air, this was one of those, like, rare, in my opinion, WWF cards where there wasn't too much filler. And, WWF, even back then was known for filler. Just look at WrestleMania 4. You had so many possibilities. And, as me and a good friend of mine like to call it, there's the disappointment factor. You had another shot at Steamboat versus Savage and, Dice. That wasn't happening, especially with them being faces at the time. So, in this scenario, you had so many feuds, about to just like blow off, in one shot, which another thing we talked about that didn't happen too often. You would have to catch it on like a Saturday night's main event to really see some feuds, go down. And, for me, this was huge, especially, and I've been on record as not being a Bret Hart fan, but this is one of the few Bret Hart matches that I absolutely adore and cherish.
All right.
And lived up to, his glory.
So let's get right into it. This is Madison Square Garden, August the 26th, 1991. 20,000 people packed to the rafters. If you've been to Madison Square Garden, you know that 20,000 is pretty much standing room only for the old garden anyway. The tagline for this was a match made in heaven and a match made in hell.
Yes, right. What a tagline that is. You couldn't pass up on something like that.
Right. So, there it is. So now, you're looking at, this is pretty big, because now 1991 is, it's a weird time in New York City, Dave. I know you're a little younger than I am, but I know we're at war with Iraq. We're in the peak of the Persian Gulf crisis. It was actually a really hot summer too. I could, if I remember.
Mm.
And now you have this, and Vince was always good with doing reality-based characters at the time. You know, because now it's the early 90s. It's still gimmick. The wrestling is still gimmicky and real. Like in terms of, it's not like everybody was a character.
Yeah.
You know. So this was actually the fourth installment of SummerSlam, and you have, let's see, the first match was a dark match. I don't even think this match was.
Didn't even make the countdown show.
No. Coco Beware fought Kato. It wasn't even on the pre-show, which was 30 minutes prior to the pay-per-view. Mm. Kato, as you all know, wasn't he Paul Diamond from the Bad?
Yeah.
Kato was Paul Diamond from the Bad Company from the AWA days. Orient Express was a good team. Coco Beware dropped him. I'm pretty sure he hit that
Ghostbuster.
The Ghostbuster, which was the Brainbuster.
Yeah.
Right.
Or the drop kick from the top rope.
All right. Well, unfortunately, Dave, I'm getting texts from the chat room that you're not coming through on the Ustream feed, but you are being recorded, so I have to work that out. I apologize. But you'll be on the podcast, so don't worry about it.
Okay.
So, all right. So I apologize. Thanks, Tank, for shouting that out to me. I want to say hi to everybody in the chat room. Are we in the chat room? Where's the chat room? There it is. Hello, chat room. Hello, everybody. All right. I'm sorry. Moving right along. The opening match was the Bulldog, Ricky the Dragon Steamboat, now just calling himself the Dragon with that god-awful, if you remember that that costume he had?
You know, I gotta say, I actually love the costume, especially the breathing the fire. That was, even now, you know, I still feel that was better than just kind of like the, you know, karate gi that he came down to the ring with, you know, previously.
Yeah, and that
thing. If you remember, once he went back to WCW, he was still doing the same thing, but he just wasn't wearing like that, you know, that weird headdress that he had on.
Right, exactly. Right, and he didn't have the dragon mask. Remember that awful dragon mask that he had that he wore sometimes to the ring? I think he saved that for WCW, right?
Yeah, I remember they had them like at the entrance whenever you know, he came out.
Right, exactly. So they both team up with the Texas Tornado, Kerry Von Erich.
Now British Bulldog,
yep.
Davey Boy Smith,
and dead. Team and they defeat the
two. A lot of guys. You know, I want to point this out. There's a lot of guys from this particular event. You know, if they were ever to do a SummerSlam '91 reunion, you know, more than half of the roster is dead.
I'm looking at it right now. I could point out 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Oh, my God. Yeah, dude. This is like a third of this card is dead.
The death toll is immense for this particular event.
Exactly. So they team up with they team up in a six-man tag against the Warlord and then Power and Glory, which was Paul Roma and Hercules.
Yeah.
Now, I was talking to Tony Z from the Wizards at the PWS show. I wasn't a big fan of Hercules per se. One of those, you know, Vince was really big on the bigger dudes anyway back then. He was super stiff, but I liked him in the tag team scenario. I liked him as a tag team. Him and Paul Roma were Power and Glory. They wore those half shirts, if you remember, the muscle shirts.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, dude. It was insane. And, of course, their manager, the mouthpiece, the great Reverend Slick.
The Doctor of Style.
That's right, brother. Love Slick. That's the thing, man. You don't have that no more, dude. You don't have the mouthpiece managers, you know? Even with guys that can talk, they like Bobby Heenan, guys like him, guys like Slick, you know, those guys could talk. Freddie Blassie, I mean, Jimmy Hart, you don't have that anymore. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, and, you know, I feel, especially now, it's absolutely necessary, but, you know, just from my experience with, you know, working with the indie scene at times, and, you know, even without the experience, you could just tell, like, it's probably even more ego-driven nowadays than it was back then. You know, some guy gets into, you know, it's pro wrestling on an independent scene, and you know, a lot of people just want to go with their own. And I also feel that's why there isn't really much of a tag team scene, you know, nowadays. You know, there's a lot more like solo wrestlers, and you know, I really feel that having that mouthpiece, you know, makes a huge difference, especially for a dude like Hercules, because even like as you mentioned, I wasn't too big into Hercules either, and I felt he kind of, you know, was a better, you know, tag team wrestler. And the dude even held the IWGP heavyweight tag titles with Scott Flash Norton.
That's right. Yeah,
you know, not too long after this. So yeah, you know, some of these guys, you know, they really, you know, especially in the entertainment side of wrestling with WWF, you know, you need somebody to get you through, you know, to the fans, especially if you're not doing your own marketing or anything like that, you know?
Right. And a lot of these tag team wrestlers, well, not Hercules, but tag team wrestlers in general that you brought up, a lot of those guys individually became superstars. So that kind of bothers me when we don't have a tag team scene, because you can, you know, you always had a good guy, a really good wrestler in a tag team, like a Bret Hart or a Shawn Michaels, those kind of guys. Paul Roma, those guys were decent workers. British Bulldog, decent worker. Kerry Von Erich always teamed up with his brothers. They were good. They were always tag teams. You know what I'm saying? You don't have that no more. So this was still in its heyday, you know. So they defeat the Warlord, Power and Glory, at 10 minutes and 43 seconds. Pretty long match for a 6-man tag. Again, though, guys, you had some talent work, you know, good talent in that ring at that point. You know?
This is like for me, like it was an incredible opening match, you know. And you can argue Hercules, Roma, Warlord, they weren't exactly the best, but you know, guys like British Bulldog, even Texas Tornado, Steamboat, you know, they really like pulled it out for this one. I even recall seeing the very rare second rope arm drag from Steamboat to Roma, which I thought was like, you know, for that time with those kind of movesets, it looked fucking awesome.
Right, absolutely. And again, all these guys were tag team wrestlers. Warlord, you know, you had, you know, of course, Paul Roma was with the Young Stallions prior. The Warlord was obviously with the Powers of Pain. You know, these guys were all tag team. Even Ricky Steamboat was a tag wrestler when he first started in the 70s with Jay Youngblood. Yeah. And I mean, again, all these guys were successful tag wrestlers. So, you know, I guess a 10-minute match with them, almost 11 minutes, I guess it, when you look at it now looking back at it, it kind of makes sense, you know?
And, you know, I think it's, well, in my opinion, I feel a lot of tag team matches, you know, are the best ways to open up a card. And, you know, this is a perfect, you know, example of you know, showcasing the strengths and hiding the weaknesses. Because, you know, frankly, to be quite honest, even in the Powers of Pain, I couldn't really sit through a Warlord match and actually caring. So
no, he actually got a singles push. This is like Slick's whole stable right here.
Yeah.
You know, he had the Warlord, and then he had the Power and Glory. He didn't have... Well, he had, obviously, he had the Earthquake and Akeem prior to that. You know, I mean, I'm sorry, Akeem and the Boss Man prior to that. But, yeah. I mean, that this was his... It was like pretty much Slick stable against the three baby faces who didn't have a storyline, so didn't have work to do, so that was cool. All right, now the next match, arguably one of the best matches in SummerSlam history, probably one of my favorite matches of all time.
Oh yeah,
it was Bret Hart versus then Intercontinental Champion Mr. Perfect, aka Curt Hennig, with the coach who was John Tolos. Another famous wrestler from the 60s and 70s, with the Tolos brothers. Tolos wrestled in, I believe, the Midwest, and he wrestled for the Crockett's. He was a big deal. But again, another wrestler that really didn't need a mouthpiece, but got one anyway, because it kind of made sense with the whole Perfect thing. And dude, how great was Perfect's vignettes leading up to his championship reign?
Oh my God! You know, these are just kind of like the things of legend. You know, him tossing the football from one end and catching it on the other. It was just like when I was a kid. You know, I believed all this stuff. And to a degree, if you watch the Mr. Perfect, you know, Life and Times of DVD, I think there's some of those guys like Wade Boggs and all that saying that he actually did some of that stuff. So I don't know about the throwing the football and catching on the other end, but, you know, it gave some legitimacy to, you know, his character. And to a degree, you know, hearing from what other people said, you know, lived up to the gimmick. And like a match like this is a perfect example of how Curt Hennig was truly Mr. Perfect.
Absolutely. For me, I got to see a lot of Curt Hennig around this time, only because my neighborhood didn't get cable until the late 80s, even as early as 1990. So cable was in its infancy in the five boroughs in New York City. And ESPN was playing the replays of all the old AWA clips.
Oh, wow.
So I got to see everything from the good stuff to the real shitty...
The turkey on a pole match.
Right, the Colonel DeBeers points tournament crap. It was just an abortion. But nonetheless, it was wrestling, and it was something else than the big two. So you just watch whatever you can watch, you know?
Yeah.
And Bret Hart.
Actually, even back then, like, I remember for me seeing WCW possibly on Saturday mornings, and there was, like, the worldwide, like, at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, like, I would take the time to see, like, what else was out there. Like, it just, especially at that time, it was really a captivating moment. This was wrestling in its prime, you know, before the Attitude Era. You know, this is, you know, the pioneering stages of, you know,
right.
Of wrestling truly being, you know, sports entertainment.
Right. Absolutely. All right. So this is the longest match of the night, believe it or not. This went like 20 minutes, almost 20 minutes. Bret Hart now is a straight out singles competitor. He's not with the Hart Foundation no more. He's getting that singles push. And this, I think, was his first IC title match, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I believe so. I don't like. I know once it was like a strange time once he left the Hart Foundation because, you know, in true fashion, wrestling fashion at that time, you know, something happened or changed. They didn't really go into it. They just kind of let it like fade away, and you know, it was one of those kind of deals where you would say with your friends like, "Whatever happened to Jim Neidhart?"
Right. He was like the forgotten guy, you know.
Yeah, it's like, oh, Bret Hart's wrestling solo. That's cool. You know, what happened to Jim Neidhart? What happened to the Hart Foundation? You know,
like nobody cared.
Exactly.
Now he's like getting arrested for robbing houses and stuff. What a hot mess.
Well, especially at that time, you know, LOD was coming into their prime, which we'll get into soon. But you know, with a team like that, in my opinion, they far outshadowed the Hart Foundation. So. When LOD was there, you know, if the Hart Foundation wasn't around, you know, I wasn't thinking too much about them.
No, neither was anybody at that point. Yeah. I missed the British Bulldogs, you know, that was a sad breakup for me. But I'm a big LOD mark anyway. They're my favorite tag team of all time, and we'll get into them, like you said, in a little while.
Yeah.
But give me some good highlights, your best highlights from this match.
Before I get into the actual stuff of the match, you know, when I was a kid, you know, anytime you saw some sort of like change in the appearance of a wrestler, you know, that always kind of like, you know, what's going on here? And one of the things that really stuck out to me was like the promo Perfect did before entering the arena, and you know, his hair was short, and you know, that was like an indicator of, you know, something was up, you know, what's going on here. And, you know, that really, like, before he hit the ring, that was kind of like, you know, like a huge indicator that, you know, there was going to be a change going on. Like, is it the sixth sense was coming in? And, but still, you know, he wasn't missing a beat. I remember from the promo, there was, like, one, like, great line that stuck out. Just that fucking, you know, cocky-ass heel sensibility. And, you know, he pulled up the belt. And he says, the belt says... wrestling champion, and to be a champion you have to be perfect, and Bret Hart, you're excellent, but you're not perfect.
That's right. That was fantastic. Again, another guy, like I mentioned before, who can do it all. He cut great promos. He was phenomenal in the ring. He was pretty much he was almost flawless. I've never seen a bad Kurt Hennig match.
No, it was, you know, it's kind of, you know, rare to see it happen because the way that the guy sold, you know, he was like a rubber ball, like bouncing it around all over the place. And, you know, I'll say, you know, one thing about this match, like the guy was selling like crazy, like how epic this match came off was insane. And, I want to make a little reference here. I know this match actually kind of reminds me of the Hogan Shawn Michaels match at SummerSlam. And I know a lot of people were shitting on Michaels for overselling in the match, but you know, that was stuff that Kurt Hennig was doing, you know, in his prime, you know?
Right.
And that was part of his character. And it was, you know, this is a cartoon more or less. And, you know, when something as high profile as the Intercontinental Championship being on the line, especially for, you know, a new singles wrestler like Bret Hart, who's trying to prove something, that was a big deal. So that selling, you know, made this match.
I agree. I never had a problem with guys selling. It depended on who the person was.
Yeah.
I mean, if T.L. Hopper was selling, I'd be throwing shit at my TV, but no.
Absolutely.
But if it's guys like Michaels or Bret Hart or Hogan and I hated Hulk Hogan as a kid.
Really?
Yeah, honestly I did. And I'll get into that when we talk about the Hogan match, but you know, I know I get it. And when certain guys sell it, and like, you know, Bret Hart and the whole Five Moves of Doom thing, listen. I just got finished watching his Dungeon DVD, and you watch stuff with him and Dynamite Kid and Tiger Mask and even him and Andre, you know, Brett sold it, man.
Yeah.
Brett entertained, and him, guys like him, Perfect, Michaels, Flair, they, you know, they can wrestle a broomstick and get it over because they showed it. They were showmen. They entertained. And you don't get that a lot anymore either. You get, like, especially with these indies, you get the spot monkeys who throw, like,
you know, finishers.
Right, 1,700 finishers, and they're kicking out. And, come on, once in a while, and I know I'm showing my age, but throw me a leg drop pin. You know, give me a superplex from the top rope. Or, you know, give me a Frankenstein, or give me a quick snap DDT and pin him. Don't give me 17 pile drivers. Don't give me don't give me none of that shit. You know, yeah. I like it, but like, it's hard to entertain an older fan now. But this was a class. If anybody wants to be entertained, if anybody wants to see a good wrestling match, showmanship, all out, just balls out, phenomenal technique, this is the match.
Yeah.
So Bret Hart does defeat Mr. Perfect for the Intercontinental Championship.
And he kicked out of the Perfect Plex, too.
Yes.
It was a rare thing.
It wasn't 17 Perfect Plexes. It was one.
No, it was one Perfect Plex. And that was kind of reserved, you know, for dudes like Hogan. You know, this wasn't like a normal thing to kick out of the Perfect Plex.
Right. Absolutely. So that was the longest match of the evening. That was the second match in, which was, you know, now sets the tone for the whole night. And
yeah.
I bet you the next match is like, oh man, how are we gonna follow this up?
Well, the next match
didn't live up to the hype.
I really don't think on their best night they could follow this match.
And I think there's only one person still alive, two people alive in this whole it's the natural disasters, earthquake and typhoon.
Three guys that were.
Yeah, I think Typhoon's still alive, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
He's going around doing the Shockmaster thing for autograph sessions. So.
Oh, stop. Oh, God. We'll save that for another podcast. But
yeah.
Yeah. Earthquake and Typhoon with the Mount of the South, Jimmy Hart, defeating the Bushwhackers, Butch and Luke, with a now Andre the Giant in their corner. This was a downtime for Andre.
Yeah.
I believe he just turned face. He was with Haku for a while, right?
Actually, at this point in time, they were teasing the fact that Andre was coming back to wrestle as a singles wrestler, and they had a bunch of managers coming in left and right, you know, to procure his services. And There's actually, I have to look for it, but I remember there was a promo with Andre in a bar hanging out with Arnold Skulland and Pat Patterson, and the Sensational Sherry approaches Andre at this bar to, you know, try to procure his services, you know, as her talents. And, you know, she tries to, you know, play the sex card to get Andre. And I forgot what happened, but I'll have to pull it up. But it was like one of the most like hilarious promos that you could see, especially with Andre and just, you know, the way that he talks and handles things. So this was more or less focusing on Andre and how Earthquake took him out of action because he did not want to have anything to do with Jimmy Hart. And yeah, I think it was either on Challenge or Superstars. You know, they were in the ring, and Andre was absolutely dead set. He did not want to be teaming up with Earthquake, and to be aligning himself with Jimmy Hart. So of course, Earthquake, you know, took him out with the megaphone. And here we have the Bushwhackers defending the honor of Andre the Giant.
Right. The Bushwhackers, who were a devastating tag team at one point in Mid-South. And
sheep herders.
Yes, they were the sheep herders. And they came here and they were the laughable, lick the kids' faces, bite the people's faces, and give them hats. And
yeah, this was one of the few times that a grown man could lick a child
and get away with
it. Be completely all right.
And I
television.
I remember going. Now, I went to a house show like right before this because the Garden still had monthly house shows, mm-hmm. And someone in my circle of I believe it was like a younger sibling of one of my friends wanted one of their hats. And if you I don't know if you remember this, but their hat was a
chewed up.
Right, exactly. It was camouflage. It was like a trucker hat, and it was chewed up. And, like, I looked at my friend, like, you paid $20 for that? Like, I could have chewed the hat for you, you know? I would have ate the hat for $20. I was starving at that point, you know? I was starving.
But, you know, I'll say this. You know, there was one thing I was very, you know, conscious of back then. And it was like, you know, some of these dudes, specifically Bushwhackers, Jim Duggan, you know, they had a huge fan base. Like, if you go back and watch this pay-per-view, it didn't matter how old you were. There was people standing up in droves doing the Bushwhacker, as Bobby Heenan would say, the March of the Morons dance.
March of the Morons. That's right. That's right. Yeah, no, they're totally over. They were totally over.
And it didn't really matter. Like, even today, you know, if I bring up wrestling to my dad or something like that, like, you know, he doesn't watch wrestling. He doesn't give a shit. But, you know, he'll ask about Hacksaw Jim Duggan or, like, the Bushwhackers, you know. Didn't matter if they were winning or losing, but it was just kind of like that, I don't know, they were just fun, you know, plain and simple. Yep. And people just got into whatever they were doing.
Absolutely. Again, the gimmick was over. Certain guys just didn't, you know, didn't matter where they were, and, you know, whether it was a 2x4 or the March of the Morons or it was, you know, whatever it was, you were over, you know. So they lose to the Natural Disasters at 6 minutes and 27 minutes. 27 seconds, I'm sorry. I can't even talk tonight.
And, you know, I'll even throw this out there. This was kind of actually like a rare loss for the Bushwhackers because if you look at their pay-per-view record, it was almost kind of flawless. You know, granted, they were having like multiple matches against the Rougeau brothers. But, you know, typically, you know, this was, you know, more or less, you know, they were more or less in a position to, you know, it's like a filler match. But, you know, typically they went over, you know, it wasn't too often that these guys would lose.
Right. Right. No, they seldom lost on pay-per-views because they had to finish the feud. That's another thing too, Dave. That's what pay-per-views lack now. You and I were talking about this in pre-production here, that you stop watching shortly after this, and you really didn't miss a lot in terms of that because these pay-per-views were built to finish the feud, you know, or to start one, you know. Yeah. So something like this, when these guys, when they're 5-6-0 in pay-per-view, It's because they were fighting these guys in house shows for like 6 or 7 months.
Yeah.
And they, like the Rougeos, like you said, or something like, you know, of that nature. And it turned out to be, you know, a win for them, you know?
Yeah.
So, all right, now, the next match is, I kind of hold near and dear to me because...
Actually, before this match came up, I don't know if you remember, but Heenan left the broadcasting booth to confront Hulk Hogan. And do you remember what he had in his hand during this, you know, small confrontation?
No, I don't. I remember him leaving the broadcast booth.
He had the belt of the real world champion,
Ric Flair. That's right. Yes. And Ric Flair was, I could paint this picture too. Ric Flair was in negotiations with WCW. Correct me if I'm wrong. And he was about to leave because Vince offered him the deal, and they, you know, Crockett said, "I want the belt back," and Flair said, "I have a deposit on it. Give me the deposit, and I'll give you your belt back."
Mm.
And they said no, so Flair took the belt, and then told Vince, "I'm coming up north, and I'm bringing the belt with me." So Vince was like, "Okay," so he must have sent the belt to Heenan. And started that whole thing, and then he I remember him being brought on. I think it was it USA? Was it Wrestling Challenge? It was definitely the USA.
Primetime.
It was Primetime Wrestling. It was, he brought out Ric Flair with the music and they you know, they video, you know, they distorted the belt and stuff like that. So
yeah, I think that didn't happen until later because he had the you know, the NWA championship for a bit. You know, at this point, like, you know, it wasn't censored. It wasn't a tag team title that was censored. Like, this was the genuine belt.
This was the real belt. This was the real deal, right? So okay, so paint that picture. So he confronts Hogan.
Well, this was kind of weird because you didn't see Hogan. It was just, you know, Heenan banging on the door or something. You know, Hogan was either having his prima donna moments or just, you know, wasn't available or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, Heenan's banging on the door, you know, saying that he's there to represent the real world champion. And, yeah, this was huge because, you know, I think at this point, like, it didn't really matter if you were a casual fan or whatever, but you knew who Ric Flair was, and for him to be entering the WWF, especially with that belt, you know, this was groundbreaking. This was not something small, but you know, as we were to find out later, you know, they completely dropped the ball on this, and you know, nothing really came up of it other than, you know, Saturday night's main event tag match and some house show singles confrontations that didn't really lead anywhere.
No, I was at the first. I was at the Garden for their first encounter.
Was this the three counts, which turned into a DQ?
Yes. I was at Madison Square Garden with my buddy Brian Kitcher. We still talk about it to this day. At my wedding, he brought it up. I was like, "Remember that?" I'm like, "Yeah." But yeah, dude. So,
I got to ask you this real quick. And, you know, this was my perception from seeing it, you know, on MSG Classics years later. But once that three count went down, did it seem like the air was sucked out of that building?
Dude, it was like a pin dropping. People were gasping. Like, I sat in, I don't know if you've been to the Garden a million times, I'm sure, right?
Yeah.
I sat in the I guess it's the baseball stadium equivalent to the mezzanine.
Bob Uecker seats?
No. I was in the dead center.
Oh.
Like, mid-level, though. Like, I was a section up from the floor.
Okay.
So I had decent seats. I mean, I sat, like, all the way in the back of that of that particular section. But, like, dude, it was, like, you 18,000. Now, these things got packed out every, you know, it wasn't rare for a Garden show to be. Every house show was packed house.
Yeah.
But it was, you could hear, it was crazy. People, like... It was like near riot. It was insane. It was insane. But yeah, I remember that vividly. That was a very
And this was still, you know, a time, you know, especially if you watch this pay-per-view, people were still like, you know, they would let their emotions, you know, out during these events. It wasn't like nowadays where people just kind of sit down and hopefully some European crowd will be there to make it exciting, you know. But this was like when people were still genuinely excited for wrestling.
Yep, absolutely. It was still a good time. Cable was in its infancy. This was before the internet, and before the internet ruined wrestling. It did, man. I mean, it was just like, you know, this is before the dirt sheets. This was when magazine subscriptions still meant something, even though they were a couple of months behind on everything.
Yeah.
It was still, you know, fresh.
Kayfabe was still alive. You know, the thing about wrestling being fake, you know, that was still something that would be brought up against, you know, maybe your brother or like their friend from high school who were like more older than you would say, isn't wrestling fake, you know, all this shit. And so, but it was still a rumor more or less, you know, when you were a kid, you know?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. So now this pseudo confrontation goes on with Bobby Heenan and Hulk Hogan, sets up that. Which everybody got, I got excited for. I was so stoked about that.
Yeah.
But the match, the match that followed was Ted DiBiase putting up his $1 million championship with Sherry Martel in his corner against Virgil.
Mm. And you know, well, we had the WrestleMania 7 match, which led to the was it DQ or countout,
right?
And which was pretty significant because you didn't really see Virgil wrestle too much, and the fans were really like, I'll say this, Virgil was red hot at this point. Probably the only time Virgil was red hot, but this was like significant. You know, this was a man getting his freedom. You know, getting his revenge for all these years of being mistreated.
Getting the shackles taken off of him.
Yes. You know, I hate to, you know, bring it up, but, you know, there totally was a race card, you know, being pulled, like the slave overcoming the slave master.
Right. But it was accepted. It was a different time. It was a different time, you know?
Yeah.
So, listen, Ted DiBiase was another one of those guys who can talk, who can wrestle. DiBiase was a phenomenal worker. He always gets on my could have been world champion, should have been world champion list.
Yeah.
You know, when that debate comes up. So he had this $1 million championship, and of course, Virgil defeats him.
Yes.
Virgil finally gets his day. He gets the pin.
It was a pin because this match had like its like ups and downs. Like I'll point this out, you know, a lot of people will be quick to say, you know, Virgil wasn't that great of a wrestler, but when he wrestled DiBiase, you know, they would go at it like you would see a good Virgil match, and this match was going all over the place. Like you had your false finish with DiBiase getting the win initially, but you know, another ref came out, Joey Morella, you know, bringing up the Sherry Martel's, you know, sensational Sherry's interference. So, you know, you had like the fans going like a rabbit at this point because she got ejected from ringside. They were starting the match all over again. You had the guys in the suits, you know, coming from the back,
right,
pulling her out, bringing her to the back, and, you know, the match was starting all over again, and Virgil had the advantage. And out of nowhere, there was a ref bump, and I love this line. This was like Heenan at his finest. You know, once Virgil was down and out, you know, the fans were kind of like, aw. But Heenan said, I hope Virgil didn't do anything stupid, like put a down payment on something like a boombox. Because Virgil was like on the verge of victory, and you know, like the rug got totally swept up from him, and Ted DiBiase pulled, you know, the cover off the turnbuckle. So, of course, especially at this point in the match, and, you know, during this, you know, day and age, you know, things weren't as predictable, you know, as they are now. And with cover exposed, you didn't know what was going to happen. And with DiBiase getting the advantage, you know, it wasn't, you know, uncommon for DiBiase to pull out a victory on a face. You know, he was that good. So, but once Virgil, you know, flipped the script and got him with that turnbuckle shot and got the pin, and the crowd erupted.
Absolutely.
This was like, for me, like, I still get the goosebumps when I watch this match, because this was like, this was huge.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
You know, people actually gave a shit about Virgil at this point, you know?
Who would have thought 20 years later he'd be selling in the Grand Central Station?
Or thrusting himself upon, you know, unsuspecting convention promoters to sell his shit last minute.
Can I have this table? No. You're back there, Virgil.
Yeah.
You're back there. That was great that, at the PWS show. Can I have this table? No, sir. You're going to go in the back. That's it. So your new $1 million champion is Virgil.
And that belt wasn't defended often.
Nope.
Or at all. I think there was only one time that it was defended. That was WrestleMania 6 against Jake Roberts, and he did not come off with the victory. And, you know, this was significant. And I remember specifically as a kid, Virgil was humiliating the $1 million man, saying how he was going to bring the belt to the ring and let the fans touch the $1 million title. You know, how awesome was that?
Yep, absolutely.
And such a slap in the face of Ted DiBiase. His belt was going to be touched by the common man, the common people.
The common folk, if you will.
Yes.
Yes, if you... All right, so... Now, this is a really good match, this next match, I thought, anyway. You brought up the Rougeau brothers before. Jacques Rougeau has a new gimmick. He is now the Mountie. He's the Canadian Mountie. He's got the cattle prod. I love the cattle prod, because when you zap people with it, WWF would actually, while you're watching on television, it would actually take the actual sound of the prod and... blast it
to make the sound effects
to make you believe that he was actually using it on his opponents, which I thought was fantastic.
Did they actually do that at the the live events?
No, they didn't. No, which I was. That's how I figured out that he didn't really use it, because listen, I mean, you know, even though I was a teenager, I still thought there was some kind of validity to it, you know.
Yeah, actually, well, I remember beforehand, if you remember his, his pay-per-view debut as the Mountie at WrestleMania 7, he went against Chico Santana.
But
they didn't have the sound effect. Like, he used the cattle prod, Chico sold it, and, everybody was happy. Well, that was, more like a filler match, so nobody really cared. But they didn't use the sound effects, so it wasn't,
Well, the Mountie didn't get to use his cattle prod in this. This was a jailhouse match where the loser had to spend 24 hours in a New York City jail.
And this was, there's a few gimmick matches for this pay-per-view, but this was something special. You know, normally you would have your loser leaves town match, or, you know, wear a dress or some shit like that. But this time around, it was, you know, two officers of the law for two separate countries. And one of these guys were going to have to spend a night in jail.
Right. Now that his adversary was the Big Boss Man, Ray Traylor, you know, I know him better as Big Bubba Rogers, who was the bodyguard of Jim Cornette and the Midnight Express. Back in the Crockett days, in the heyday of the Crocketts, anyway.
Or if you were Dusty Rhodes, you call him Big Bubba.
Big Bubba, if you will. I'm coming for you.
Bubber.
Big Bubba, I'm going to come for you, Daddy. Yes, if you will. The Buddha Woods. I love Dusty Rhodes, by the way. I wish Dusty.
He got a bicycle.
He got a bicycle. He hit him in the head and in the groin with a tartar seat. I love Dusty, but that's right. But the Boss Man, I liked Ray Traylor. I was always a big fan of his work. A year prior to this, he was still a bad guy. He had Fort Hogan. It was a Saturday afternoon house show, and this is probably one of my favorite Hulk Hogan matches of all time. Again, didn't like Hulk Hogan. I'll get into that at the end of this. And they fought. They had a cage match. Now, back in the day, cage matches signified that this feud was coming to a head. Somebody wasn't walking away right, you know?
Yeah.
This was the big deal. So he fought Boston.
Was that out of control that it had to be placed into the confines of a 15-foot-high steel cage?
Right. And this was the they were still using the WrestleMania 2 cage, that big bulky blue one.
Yes.
And Hogan actually threw a suplex from the cage.
Which was, you know, insane for right. Hogan.
For me, seeing that live, I almost fucking threw my food up. I was like, I couldn't believe it. I was like, I honestly, dude, I was like, I talked about that for like a year, man. I on a train ride home and like, you know, magazines. And I was really into the whole pen pal and tape trading thing back then with the wrestling magazines. So this was a big deal.
You know, granted, you got some years on me, but this was also a Coliseum home video match that they had from the Garden. This was on several.
I've never seen it on. I've never seen it on video. I was live.
Really? I'm gonna have to dig it up for you.
Dude, I would love to see it. Yeah. I was there. I was in the crowd. It was insane. But all right. So fast forward 1 year. Anyway, Boss Man is the real match
at hand.
Yes, I'm sorry. You know what? You got me going now. We talk about stuff, and I'm seeing these guys in print, and I'm thinking about stuff that's leading up to this, and there's so many things you can go into. Because again, it was so character ridden and so well put together that you know. You remember even the bad stuff was good. You know what I'm saying? If that makes sense, you know. All right. So the Big Boss Man defeats the Mountie at 9:38, and the best part of this was New York's Finest actually dragging him bodily, into a paddy wagon going to Central Booking. That was fantastic.
Yeah, this was like one of those kind of things where I think what happened after the match, you know, overshadowed the match, which was completely fine because the vignettes that they had with the Mountie going to jail from him just screaming at the top of his lungs, "I'm the Mountie! You can't do this to me! I'm the Mountie!"
That was so good.
It was just like, oh my god, it was priceless. From like one of my there's like two things that really stood out, and that was the fingerprinting.
Yes.
Which he refused to, you know, give any of his fingers. And the officer kept saying, "Give me your finger." And he's like, "I'll give you the finger." And then that's when he fucking gave him, like, the middle finger, the bird. And, well, now it's blocked off. But back then it was not blurred out. And which was fine. Like, everybody got the joke. And it was great, and they just grabbed his middle finger and then just started, you know, pressing it onto the ink and, you know, pressing it down, and it was insane. Like, it was perfect. Like, I noticed for this event in particular, most of the faces got over, but you know, for fans at that point in time, most people were into the faces, so this was, like, the perfect pay-per-view for any kind of, like, wrestling fan at this point.
Yes. Yes, and again, the NYPD was so cool doing this whole thing with them. I thought it was a cool like gesture, I guess, to WWF. Because this was before the whole reality based thing, man. This was a way before that. So doing stuff like this was like, wow. You like, if you were a kid, like if you were my stepson's age, you were believing that he was going to jail, man. It was like,
yeah, like he was going to be in jail for that night. And, you know, another classic moment, I think it was like the last that we saw of the Mountie for that night, was he was in the jail cell and there was like some drunk dude, you know, like accosting him, saying, you know, what was he saying? I actually took notes, believe it or not.
No, that's what I want you to do, man. This is so great. Go ahead.
Yeah. What was, oh my God, what was it? Like, he was saying something about my buddy, you know, don't mess with my buddy. And, you know, Mountie doesn't give a shit. He just wants to get the hell out of there. And, you know, this drunk guy's like, you want to meet my buddy? And then, like, he turns around and it's like this, like, tough, badass, like, biker looking dude with a leather jacket. And, you know, the Mountie actually has, like, this look of terror in his face. You know, despite this guy looking like something out of the Warriors, and with the friggin' headband around his head, And, you know, the Mountie's just, like, struck in fear. And then the guy speaks. And he says, "Don't you like the way that leather feels against your body?"
He starts screaming.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Screaming. I remember that. That was fantastic.
You know, this is, you know, probably one of the earliest, you know, phases of a rape joke that was acceptable, you know, at that time.
Again, it would never fly now. It would never fly.
Yeah.
But very entertaining nonetheless. Yes. So your sixth match of the evening was my favorite tag team of all time, the Legion of Doom, Hawk and Animal, facing the Nasty Boys, Brian Knobbs and Jerry Sags, for the WWF Tag Team Championship.
And what I'll say is probably the cleanest no DQ match I've ever seen in my entire life.
Right. The Nasty Boys had a reputation of doing matches like this, going back to WCW.
Yes.
One in particular, if you remember the one Halloween Havoc that they fought the Steiner Brothers, if you remember that match.
Yeah.
And they would beat each other up with concessions. And
for the U.S. tag titles, I believe.
Yes, indeed they were. And they were known for that kind of style. They fought guys like Max Payne and Mick Foley and the Varsity Club and at that point so they had a reputation. Coming here was just a natural progression for them, and of course, Legion of Doom. Now, listen, Legion of Doom. They've done it all. So now this is like their last stop before they start to wind down.
Yeah, and this was actually a historical moment for them, because this is. They were the only tag team to hold the AWA, the NWA, and now the WWF Tag Team Championships.
Yep, and I believe like them and Vader, whose birthday is today, by the way.
Happy birthday, Vader.
Happy birthday, Big Van Vader. They are him and the Legion of Doom, I think, are the only tag team to hold belts consecutively in multiple continents.
Yeah, you know, one thing about the LOD, which Piper during this pay-per-view was saying stood for Lookout Dummy. But they were just like one of these teams that, you know, they could get away with anything. They were just absolutely cool. You know, it didn't matter if they were faces or heels. Fans loved them.
Yeah, I am, this summer, I'm coming up on a year of doing this podcast, and I'm actually going to be, and maybe you can help me with this too, maybe we'll get you back on the podcast. I really want to do an entire podcast on the Road Warriors. There's so much to do with them. And like you said, whether they were good, bad, no matter what promotion they fought for, those guys were fantastic.
Yeah.
They looked the part, they spoke it, they were stiff as hell, and they had some of the greatest matches, man. Honestly, I remember Hawk getting singles title shots against Ric Flair in the NWA.
Yeah.
Dude, it was like insane. Like, I remember watching like the Clash of the Champions going like, I can't believe this may actually happen.
Like, and at the same time, it was actually believable that he could win the World Heavyweight title.
Hawk was taking nothing away from Animal, Hawk was just a freak of nature. He had the power. He was 300 pounds almost. He had the speed. These guys were deadlifting like 800 pounds at a clip at one point.
Yeah.
There's so much to get into. But this is I think it was their debut pay-per-view, I believe.
At WrestleMania 7 in a match against Power and Glory. And they appeared at SummerSlam 90 during the Demolition, Heart Foundation, 2 out of 3 falls tag title match.
They helped out the Heart Foundation, that's right. So I stand corrected. I remember that. So they actually, like you said before, one of the cleanest street fights you'll ever see. They defeated.
Yeah, every horrible, you know, thing that you could imagine being done during a match was all done behind the referee's back. There was even a point where I think the Nasty Boys were putting hairspray, you know, in Hawk's eyes or Animal's eyes during the match. Referee's back was turned during this. They were using the friggin' Jimmy Hart's motorcycle helmet. All this stuff done behind the ref's back. Even they took the cooler, threw it against Hawk's back. All done behind the referee's back.
Right. Right, absolutely. So,
with the exception of the finish, I think they were teasing that the Nasties were going to be using the helmet again to pick up the victory, and of course it gets in the hands of Animal, and you know, the rest is history.
Yep. Your new tag team champions are Hawk and Animal, the Legion of Doom, at 7 minutes and 45 seconds.
And I got to say this was particularly huge, because especially with Legion of Doom, Road Warriors in the WWF, you had some great battles against, you know, teams that you wanted to see them go against, particularly guys like the Nasty Boys or Demolition, who had face paint too, or, you know, had some sort of tough guy gimmick. Because anytime guys with face paint faced each other, that was huge. Right. There didn't have to be a storyline. The storyline was two guys wearing face paint, or just two badasses going head to head. So this was particularly a dream fight, in a sense. I don't really remember too much of what their history was before this, but just these two teams going against each other was a perfect match.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Again, the Nasty Boys, like I said earlier, they were known for doing stuff like this.
Yeah.
So it was just a natural thing. And Legion of Doom, or Legion of Dooms, they could do anything, you know, at that point. Absolutely. They wrote their own ticket, which, you know, again, I'm seriously working on doing an entire podcast about the LOD, which is going to happen soon. So your next match was one of those matches that could have been the curtain jerker. And this this happens a lot, and it's, to this day, it bothers me. It just happened at WrestleMania. They put these matches in between the main events, or in between title matches, that should have been curtain jerkers.
Yeah, this is like a dark match kind of thing. But I think the purpose of this match, kind of like what we talked about earlier with the Mountie facing Chico Santana, WrestleMania 7, and so on and so forth, this is a debut match for a particular guy that they've been hyping up for a while.
That's right, paying taxes.
This was nothing to talk about. This was totally the, hey, let's, you know, get some hot dogs and food, or take a whiz kind of time in the card.
Yeah. Mike Rotundo was a really good worker for a very long time. He wrestled in the NWA, former WWF tag team champion, former NWA television champion, and U.S. tag champion with the Varsity Club with Kevin Sullivan and Dr. Det Steve Williams, rest in peace, and Rick Steiner. So, you know, he's made his rounds. He's been everywhere in the world. Now he's this Erwin Ausscheister. And like you said, it was one of those matches where you have to hype up the one guy. And he played these vignettes of him in the glasses, pay your taxes, tax man's coming, blah, blah, blah. And he fights another former legend of the Squared Circle, which is Greg the Hammer Valentine.
And I got to say this about this match, and I find this kind of interesting, because anytime somebody was doing a debut match or just filler match in general for a big WWF pay-per-view, Greg the Hammer was the guy. He was the king of the filler matches from the late 80s on.
Right. Right, and I believe he had a few with Ronnie Garvin around this time, or right after this.
Yeah, that was one of the few non-filler matches. They had the submission match at the Royal Rumble 1990.
Right, with the whole the figure four, with the shin guard thing, and
yes,
all that nonsense.
And Garvin had the, well, it wasn't quite called the sharpshooter at the time.
No.
But I remember they were calling it the reverse figure four.
Yes, yes.
To kind of get over on, you know, Valentine and his figure four like Loxo.
Ronnie Garvin was old back then too, dude. Like, he was in like his 40s at that point. He's like in his 70s now. I didn't realize how old he was till recently.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. And they played the storyline like he was brothers with Jimmy Garvin. But in real life, that was like his stepdad.
Really?
Yeah, it was creepy, like, but yeah. Ronnie Garvin was a, listen, he was a former world champion, so kudos to him.
Yeah.
Now, this is the main event. This is why Mega Powers reached out to me. This is the match of the evening, if you will. This is
the first of the match made in, you know, whatever place. The match made in hell.
Right. Right. Now, the wedding ceremony was after this, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so all right. So now this is Hulk Hogan and the Ultimate Warrior facing the now Iraqi sympathizer, Sergeant Slaughter.
Yes.
General Adnan, who is Sheikh Anan Casey from Texas, from World Class.
Mm-hmm.
And Colonel Mustafa, you know him better as the the lovable Iron Sheik.
Yes. Which I thought was, there was something interesting because, you know, this was a time when if they repackaged somebody, they didn't really talk about their past. But this night we had Rowdy Piper on the mic, who absolutely did not give a shit. And there's a rare clip out there of what was Tony Atlas's African gimmick?
Samba Simba.
There was a rare moment. It was like a Superstars or a Challenge or one of those. And it was Piper and McMahon on the mic, and Saba Simba's coming to the ring for his debut match, and Piper immediately says, "Hey, isn't that Tony Atlas?" And, of course, Vince McMahon, you know, being of sound mind and body and not on a ton of cocaine at the point, says, "No, that's Saba Simba." But, of course, Piper was very insistent that this was Tony Atlas. And Piper wasn't that crazy for this event, but there was a moment during the match where Colonel Mustafa had had Hogan in the camel clutch, and Piper yells out, "I remember this from 83, even though it happened in 84.
84. January 23rd, 1984, yes. Yes. Getting back to Hulk Hogan, I was never a Hulk Hogan fan, per se. I was a kid that always rooted for the bad guys.
Yeah.
No matter what age I was, from the age of 6 or 7 on, and I loved the bad guys. For me, they were just cooler looking. And I was kind of pissed as a young kid, because when LJN put the action figures out, Hulk Hogan was the only one with a belt.
So no, they had belts with, I believe, the Bulldogs and
the tag team titles, yes. But for the singles belt, they were all different colors. The original LJN series.
Yeah.
I saved like 7 weeks of change to go to the local drugstore in my neighborhood to buy the Hulk Hogan doll just so I could put it on Paul Orndorff's waist. And I hated the way he looked because it was stupid to pose, but I was a Paul Orndorff guy growing up anyway.
Yeah, so. And it was that, and it was strange because the belt that Hogan came with was the 84 title, even though these figures were coming out like, you know, after
86.
The fact that this, you know, the big, we all know that the Flair's belt was called the big gold belt. I like to call this like the big green ugly belt.
Right, yes, exactly. Exactly. Again, I was never a big Hulk Hogan fan, but I even as a kid, though, I knew the significance of Hulkamania, and I knew what he brought to the table. And I knew when he was main eventing, they always premiered him with the top bad guy. So it was always fun to watch him compete in the Garden. And I did appreciate him in my early 20s. I actually got, I wish I still had them, a lot of his IWGP stuff. His stuff in Japan is fantastic.
That's where he actually wrestled.
Exactly, that was my thing. I'm like, I can't believe he actually wrestles. And yeah. You see him against Baba and Saruta and Muda and
Inoki and Andre the Giant.
And Andre, yeah, it was amazing. I wish I still had that stuff because I appreciated that. You know, I appreciate Hulk Hogan, Ultimate Warrior. Not so much. And
There was some controversy with the Warrior for this event.
There was. There was a off-screen incident with the Warrior. This goes back to the self-destruction of the Ultimate Warrior DVD. Now, Vince alleged that Warrior was going to no-show the event because he was supposed to be paid like a certain amount of money.
Yeah.
If that's how it goes, okay. So Hogan and Slaughter, apparently, we're in cahoots. They're going to deal with it. Let's take him outside, Vince. Let's, you know, let's break his face and blah, blah, blah. Because back then, that's what
that was the mentality.
And when dudes held out for money, they did stuff like that, especially in the smaller promotions, especially in the NWA.
Yeah.
So they were to deal with it, and then when they became aware of what was going on with the Warrior. So now Vince says that he didn't want Hogan and Slaughter to do that. And a matter of fact, paid him whatever he wanted and fired him immediately after SummerSlam.
Yeah.
Right?
And I'm pretty sure Warrior, even though, I don't know what our status is now, but he's a friend of mine. But I'm pretty sure he had something different to say about the whole situation. Which, you know, it is what it is. But, you know, for wrestling fans, this was kind of like an interesting kind of aside, you know, going on for this, because, you know, when you're watching this stuff, especially when it was going down, to your point, there was no dirt sheets, there was no internet to figure out any of this kind of stuff. It was something that you would hear years down the road, and it was like, wow, Warrior held up McMahon for money before this event, because, you know, when you watch it, for me, you know, the event just went smoothly. You didn't think twice about anything that could have been going on behind the scenes, you know, other than, you know, the kayfabe storylines. But that was kind of significant. And, you know, when you're a wrestling fan, whether you knew it was real or you knew it was fake, whatever, it was just kind of an interesting kind of perspective being brought to the whole you know, story of like what's going on the kayfabe side and the reality of it all. And it's kind of intense when you think about it, especially when Warrior came back, what, like a year later?
Right. And like he responded later on to these like quote unquote allegations. Like he was insisting that he was owed money for his performance at WrestleMania 7.
Yeah.
Right. So McMahon would later state that like he couldn't make the last minute change in the card due to the fans. And he couldn't wait to fire and blah, blah, blah. I did get it.
I think something for like this, you would want to just have the match and just handle business afterwards.
Right. And I saw the DVD in 2005. Around 2009, I started watching his YouTube, his motivational speaking things or whatever it was. Okay. And, you know, you saw it then too. Not that he was cocky, but he was that guy that, you know, knew his place in the business. He was in the right place at the right time. He really wasn't doing it to be a wrestler. He had a deal offered to him when he was quasi-famous and before Texas. And like, you know, he just was in the right place at the right time, made his money, and he walked away. It wasn't like a thing where he is one of these guys that lives in the moment, has to be at the conventions, he lived a clean life, you know, raised a family, and banked on his success.
Yeah.
A little weird, yeah. I mean, when you listen to some of his YouTube stuff, when you watch his promos, he wasn't, like, the best talker. He wasn't even, like, the best wrestler. But he had a look to him. I love when he beat Hogan in Toronto. That was fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
That was fantastic. And
that's another story for another podcast.
Oh, dude, yeah, dude, I'm getting all these ideas as we're talking. This is going to be a fantastic summer. Yeah. But you had a sense of where he was in his life then, even when he came back the year after. They brought him back SummerSlam, I believe it was 90. When did he fight Triple H? That was 90.
I want to say 97.
Right, and then he went to WCW. So he got chances, and Vince was always good with that stuff, man.
Yeah.
What we didn't talk about though in the main event was Sid Justice being the special guest referee.
Yes, and as Heenan would say during the event, this guy would make coffee nervous.
I love Bobby Heenan, man. I love him to death. So there it is. Now you have the ceremony. So Dave, why don't you paint?
Actually, before we get into the match made in heaven, I wanted to bring this up, and I thought this was a classic, excellent WWF storytelling, and you know, kind of foreshadowing about what was to come. Before the match, they had the Triangle of Terror, as they were called, confronting Sid Justice to join them.
Oh, that's right. Yes.
So this was kind of teasing Sid's eventual heel turn, but you know, obviously he didn't go with the Triangle of Terror. But I think there was like a point during the match where, yeah, Hogan bumped into Justice, and they kind of had you know, a stare down. But like this was so perfect of like how good the WWF could be back then. They would just drop something as little as that, just two guys bumping into each other, which would eventually turn out into this like all-out war down the road.
Yes.
But, you know, and, you know, going back as far as, you know, the mega powers exploding, you know, I remember the earliest instance of that, I think, was the Royal Rumble. And then with Hogan eliminating Savage and somebody else at the same time. And, of course, you know, there's no, you know, there are no friends in the Royal Rumble.
They're a man for himself.
And I think there was, like, another little, like, little thing that they teased. And I think that may have been at Survivor Series where, you know, they won the match and Hogan is hugging Liz. And Savage just has, like, this look on his face, like, what are you doing? Why are you touching my woman?
Yeah.
And it wasn't really brought up too much on the commentary side of things. It was just a visual thing that if you didn't catch it and if you weren't aware of it, like, it would just kind of slip by you.
And then it was the breakup on Saturday night's main event.
Yeah, and because, after the end of this match, you know, Hogan and Sid Justice, they were posing in the ring. Nothing was wrong. And then, you know, which would segue into the Saturday night's main event breakup.
Right. Exactly.
And the destruction of the barbershop.
Ah, yes, that's right. That's right. That's right. So now we segue into the wedding.
Yeah.
And why don't you set this up, since you saw this recently and I didn't?
This was huge because everybody knew that there was something between Macho Man and Miss Elizabeth.
Right.
But, you know, this was still the 80s and early 90s. And, you know, that kind of relationships weren't really discussed. And whatever relationships there were was
valets.
Yeah, valets, like, or doll, you know, Uncle Elmer getting married to whoever. Nobody cared about that. It was just more, you know, just like a fun little thing. But this was something completely different. This was like a top guy and, you know, his valet for years. And they were publicly acknowledging that there was a relationship between them. And, you know, I know it all came down to the proposal on Superstars, I believe it was. But I know you were a veteran of the house shows at this time. I don't know if you remember it, but you know, from me seeing it on, you know, MSG Classics, which I wish they still had. Maybe that would still have cable if they had it on.
I have Classics on demand. I pay like the extra $8 a month for it.
Yeah,
and once in a while they do show stuff like that, but they haven't showed anything that was.
But they had since this was a house show, this wasn't really going out, you know, on TV all over the place.
Right.
But there was actually a rare barbershop at a MSG house show where the special guest was Macho Man. And Brutus Beefcake was actually the one who broke the story on Savage going to propose to Miss Elizabeth. Were you at this show?
Right. Was I at the garden? They didn't do it in the garden.
Yeah, this was at the Garden. It was a house show. It was televised on MSG Network.
Barbershop. Yes. This was 90. This had to be
It was like a few. I think it was like a. It was the same week as when they were going to air the episode of Superstars where Macho Man proposes to Miss Elizabeth.
Right. So you're looking like 3 or 4 months before that.
Yeah.
I was definitely there for that. Definitely there for that. It was. When they did segments in the garden, like if they did a Piper's Pit or a barbershop, it was usually right before an intermission. Because how they would set things up was you would have the main event before the intermission, because then Howard Finkel would come out and announce next month's card.
Yes.
Which would set up the, obviously what was going on. So this was right before a main event. I think I have to look at my. I wish I could find my programs. I still have some of them. I kept some of them.
Wow.
But yeah, I have to show you, dude. It's awesome shit. But yeah, that was a fun time, and I didn't really like Macho Man as a good guy. He kind of bothered me. I mean, I loved him to death. Don't get me wrong, but I liked him better as a heel. You know, at this point.
But, yeah, he most of his career was as a heel,
right,
and you know, more or less, that's what the public knew him as. And even when he was retired, if you listen to some of his commentary, especially at this time, he would still on occasion side with the heels. You know, even especially if they were against Hogan, you know, he would just kind of pepper it in there a little bit. It wasn't like a strong thing, but he would kind of tease that he was still a heel,
right,
despite the fact that he was not anymore.
Right. So here we are. This is the wedding. This is this was a big deal. Let me see if I can pull up something here. Yeah, it was the on-screen wedding of Savage and Elizabeth, the match made in heaven. They had been married in real life since December I believe it was 1984 or 5.
Wow.
The personalities that were there were Vince McMahon. Let's see. They had a reception. Bobby Heenan, Mean Gene. J.J. Dillon was a backstage guy back then. Yes. Undertaker was brand new in the company, and Jake Roberts.
And Macho Man had his pimp hat.
Right. So the Undertaker and Roberts were the last two uninvited guests, right?
Yeah.
So Jake proceeds to frighten Elizabeth with a... Well, it was a box. And the box opened, and a snake, a cobra, came out. And while Liz was startled, Savage gets cracked in the face by Undertaker with the urn.
Yes.
So that now that sets up, again, another feud, which was awesome. So,
and continued the success rate of WWF marriages gone wrong.
I think that started it.
No, the Uncle Elmer one from Saturday Night's Main Event. Piper came out and disrupted that.
You know, they talk about, speaking of Uncle Elmo, they talk about guys holding out for money. I just recently heard a podcast that Hillbilly Jim was on, and he said Uncle Elmer was a douchebag, and he held out for money at certain spots, too.
How can that guy hold out for money? Nobody gave a crap about him.
Exactly. So
he had one of the worst WrestleMania matches, in my opinion, the one with Adonis at WrestleMania 2.
Oh, please. Please.
Talk about a filler pay-per-view right there.
Oh, 2 was great, though, man. 2 was fantastic.
It was fun. The main events were, absolutely unreal. But, some of the matches that preceded those main events were just kind of like, okay.
Yeah, well,
can't win them all.
No. It was 1985. Yeah. At that point. But I thought the simulcasting... 86, I'm sorry. Was simulcasting from three different places was fantastic. I wish I could have been at the Nassau Coliseum. I wasn't at the time, though. But so that's SummerSlam 1991. Very memorable. A really good time for wrestling still. The gimmick was still in effect. Vince was on top of the world.
This was like one of the, in my opinion, probably one of the last like really like great WWF pay-per-views.
Yeah, man, you had some Again, you had stories in stories. The Legion of Doom, of course, being the first tag team to win all the belts. Bret Hart winning his first singles championship, beating Mr. Perfect, having his parents in the audience. The whole Iraqi sympathizer thing. The Ric Flair thing. Yeah, so there was so many underlying stories that were intertwined with this pay-per-view that it was only fitting that that you bring this to my attention, that we should be doing this. So, and I appreciate you coming on tonight. That was really cool. Very much so. Thank you.
Yeah, so, thank you, man.
Hitting Rock Bottom, how's it going? What's going on with Hitting Rock Bottom?
It's going great. The four episodes that we filmed are all on the website, hittingrockbottomshow.com. So right now we're going to be going more into the crowdfunding phase of this all because same cheap folks, you know, this is all coming out of my friend's pocket. And, you know, if you've seen the show, you can see that it's actually top-notch, you know, for an indie production. So we're going to have to reach out to our fans and, you know, see what we can do to make more of these episodes because it's a very original concept, the drug addiction and drug recovery docudrama. And, you know, it's very something special. And, you know, a lot of feedback that I've been getting from people is that, you know, this is something that could be on TV. With the quality that it is, the storytelling, everything. And, you know, the more we can get the word out there and the more that we could film and create and present to people, you know, hopefully this can be the start of something beautiful for all of us. So.
Absolutely. And it was great when we had you on the Will and Phil Awful podcast. We were just showing it to other people in our circle. And, you know, like, I know it hits home for me. We already spoke about that.
Yeah.
But when you show it to other people and it hits home for them, it's nice that stuff like this is being done still, that there's still an awareness to it. Because, you know, I grew up in the 80s where everything was a PSA.
Yeah.
You know, everything like sitcoms and cartoons and comic books and milk cartons and candy.
Video games.
Everything was a PSA. I think we lack that as a society. So not to bring the podcast here down, but check out hittingrockbottomshow.com. Dave and Corey did a phenomenal job on that. Again, Dave, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. I'm going to have you back. We're going to do some cool stuff. I got some. I already got some stuff working. I mean, plot and stuff. I mean, we could talk about old school wrestling all the time. This is just something that I love doing.
Yeah, and as you know, I like to avoid anything new concerning American wrestling, well, mainstream wrestling. If it's in Japan or on the indies, you know, I'm all for it, but
yeah,
WWE and to a degree TNA,
yeah, I
could care less.
Dave, like me, is putting old school wrestling stuff on Facebook, which that's Studplex, is right.
Oh, that's a secret group, so we can't talk about stuff.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was open. I'm sorry. Well, you can check out. I'll plug the other stuff on them when I disconnect with you. But
yeah,
but yeah, but
promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, you! Thank you so much for downloading this. We really appreciate it. Please continue to support the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast by going to iTunes and Stitcher and leaving a review. Go to turnbucklethrowbacks.com, get all of our back catalog as well as all of our friend shows. Go to rantemradio.com, click on the live link every Friday, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, and of course all of our friend shows over there as well. We have four different t-shirts. You want to rock our gear? Go to prowrestlingtees.com/turnbuckle throwbacks. Get the fresh gear right now. Of course, as always, thank you so much for supporting the Turnbuckle Throwbacks Wrestling Podcast. We appreciate it, and we love you all. Peace!
If you're looking for hot, wet, sizzling wrestling talk, you need to listen to the Shining Wizards Wrestling Podcast. Four hot studs from New Jersey, guaranteed to satisfy your cardinal wrestling desires. Listen to them on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Audio Booth, and the Shining Wizards Network. Visit them at shiningwizards.com. It's Wrestling Talk. Ooh, and talk about wrestling.
Hey everyone, this is Justin, one of your hosts of Inconclusive Breakdown, a weekly uncensored and anti-PC look at entertainment, pop culture, professional wrestling, and current events. We also do a weekly top 10 list and fan casting. You can find our show on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or the Satchel app for Android, or you can download direct from Libsyn. So come on out of your safe space and join us in the real world, won't you?
Hey, you! Yeah, you over there. If you're into professional wrestling, heavy metal music, and getting hammered, Neckbreaker Podcast was designed just for you.
Wrestling headlines, metal panels, and guest interviews with past alumni, including Suffocation, Eric Bischoff, Hammerfall, Chris Jericho, and many more.
Grab a 30-rack and listen to Neckbreaker on iTunes, the Shining Wizards Network, Stitcher Radio, the Blast Syndicate, or just grab the episodes right now from neckbreaker.net. Cheers and beers.
What?
The following announcement has been paid for by the Ike World Order.
Forget about that. You just
Action
brought up
Gary Hart will whip his ass.
Tony C just brought up Ike Turner. How awesome was Lawrence Fishburne in that movie?
Oh, excellent.
I'm sorry to get off topic, but he was amazing.
Play that role. Nah. I got San Antonio. Nah.
Stop now. Ike said he only hit her once.
He beat her with a shoe!
He said he only smacked her once.
He smacked her once, but he hit her with everything else.
I hit her with everything but the kitchen sink now, dog, but I'm saying.
Did you see that? You see that look in his eye?
Now he's more of a man than Rage.
Ooh, wait a minute now.
Oh, yes, Wax.
Wait a second. This is the co-host of the Wrestling Colon Show.
That was all right. So disrespectful.
Alright.
Nah, Steve, I can't have you.
That's why your girl's about to get eliminated from the Amazing Race.
You see that? I've never questioned your manhood, Rage.
Bullshit, you didn't, Ike. Surfer.
Tony.
You never ever questioned your manhood.
Trying to help
no,
Ike.
You did it. Yo, you always do it.
How?
The preceding announcement has been paid for by the Ike World Order. The Wrestling Call-In Show, every Saturday evening on RantEMRadio.com.
Hey, it's Mike from The Midnight Jury. Join myself and my co-hosts, Adam, Cal, and Sydney, as we bring to you the best in 80s and 90s pop culture, pro wrestling, and horror movies. You can join in the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, and we are available at our home at WLWstudios.com, along with the Midnight Jury feeds on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and TuneIn Radio. Forget about Blu-ray, forget about iPhones, and forget about flat-screen TVs, and travel back with us to the last old-school generation when it was all about Walkmans, arcades, and malls. Once again, that's The Midnight Jury, available on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, and our home at WLWstudios.com.
Bombadida, 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 about the clouds when we're together. Just sing a song and think about sunny weather. Happy trails to you till we meet again.